Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, welcome to our show today. I'm Nevedita Kaur, the host of the Anthropology Channel of the New Books Network, and today we are joined by Nicholas Kaywa to talk about his most recent book, Amazonia in the Anthropocene, People, Soils, Plants, Forests. Hi, Nick. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, welcome to our show today. I'm Nevedita Kaur, the host of the Anthropology Channel of the New Books Network, and today we are joined by Nicholas Kaywa to talk about his most recent book, Amazonia in the Anthropocene, People, Soils, Plants, Forests. Hi, Nick. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you. So why don't we start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came about being an anthropologist?
Yeah, so for most people in the U.S., I think they're usually not familiar with the field of anthropology probably until they go to college and maybe take, you know, a general education course as, you know, as part of their sort of college career. But, you know, for me, I was a little bit more aware of it as a child just because my uncle is an anthropologist.
Oh, cool.
So my uncle, Sandy Davis, had worked and done research among Maya people in Guatemala, Cachiquel speakers, I believe. And then he also went on to work in Brazil, and he wrote a book called Victims of the Miracle. And it was looking at the Brazilian, what was referred to as the economic miracle of the 1970s, where there was a lot of infrastructural development and a lot of economic promise in Brazil. But he focused on you know, really devastating impacts that that had on indigenous populations, especially in Amazonia. So from an early age, you know, I was aware of anthropology because of his work, and he would oftentimes send me, you know, little mementos from his travels and time both in Central America and South America. And so, you know, from a very early age, I was really intrigued by anthropology. And then later I kind of, you know, got into other fields, and I was interested in biology and ecology and geology, which was actually my major starting out as an undergrad. And then I kind of quickly realized that, you know, the geologists really weren't my people. And even though anthropologists, you know, I took some anthropology courses, and I wasn't 100% convinced that at the onset, but over time it really came to be the discipline that I grew to love.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And then what about specifically with your motivations for becoming involved in writing a book on pre-Columbian Amerindians and contemporary rural Amazonians? Like, why did you choose the Amazon as your focus?
Yeah, in some ways it kind of happened through serendipity. So I was interested in Brazil as an undergraduate. And, you know, initially I'd taken some classes in Spanish, and then I was at the University of Arizona, and they offered Portuguese classes as well as part of the Spanish minor program that I was doing. So I took a Portuguese class based on the recommendation of a friend. And, you know, initially I thought, like, Spanish would be a practical language to learn, especially, you know, there in the Southwest. But I really became enamored with Brazilian Portuguese. And so when I was finishing my undergrad degree, I was convinced that I had to go to Brazil and find a way to do it. And you know, the way that ended up happening is I got a position teaching English in Brazil. And my placement, you know, I initially planned on maybe going to the Northeast to the state of Bahia, or maybe to Rio de Janeiro. And I ended up getting a placement in the city of Manaus, which is the largest city in the Brazilian Amazon.
Wow.
And while I was there, I ended up getting developing a relationship with a research institute there, where I was able to do an internship, and that led on to, you know, further research. And I went on to graduate school and really wanted to focus human environmental relations in Brazilian Amazonia, looking, you know, across a pretty broad swath of time, looking at how people, you know, early Amazonians had really shaped their environment in subtle but persistent ways, but also looking at how contemporary Amazonian populations were continuing to shape the Amazonian environment. And in some cases, they were benefiting from environmental modification and alteration by past populations, early Amerindian populations. And so the example that stands out, which I spent a lot of time looking at, was the soils known as Amazonian dark earth in English, or terra preta do Índio in Portuguese. They were these environments of fairly persistent soil fertility that were the product of long-term management and deposition of organic materials and other agricultural refuse, and, you know, just refuse from daily village living, that led to these very fertile lands that were wildly productive for agriculture. And so, you know, I was witnessing how people today were farming on areas that were the result of, you know, hundreds of years of management and use.
Yeah. So also, I mean, something in your book that I've noticed is this, the conceptualization of the Anthropocene. I mean, it's part of your title as well. So maybe could you describe what that means, this concept, to our listeners, and maybe elaborate on its construct?
Yeah, so the Anthropocene is a term and you know, a concept that's gained a lot of traction. And some people, you know, in some circles are tired of hearing about the Anthropocene. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, you know, globalization or sustainability from, I don't know, you know, a few years ago, where it seems to be everywhere. But in the most basic terms, the Anthropocene is a new proposed geological epoch, or a new proposed geological time period that's defined by the pervasive human influence or human impacts on the Earth. And, you know, as I was writing this book, I was looking at how Amazonian people had shaped their environments over hundreds and even thousands of years. And I started kind of putting some of my research into conversation with some of the broader scholarly conversations about the Anthropocene. And there was a lot of debate, you know, about there was a general consensus that humans had, you know, radically altered the planet. And then the question was, well, where do we kind of where do we decide where the defining line is, where we've moved from the Holocene, the past geological epoch, into this new one known as the Anthropocene? And that continues to be a source of debate, but the early discussions really focused on the Industrial Revolution in Europe, and that, you know, how you know, Europe had developed technologies that allowed for pretty incredible transformation of the planet. And then, you know, later there were discussions about whether that should actually be bumped up to, you know, the period around World War II or post-World War II period, which is actually the date that's now being proposed by the Anthropocene Working Group. But I was, you know, trying to point out that people had also been really radically altering and modifying their environments long before Europe's Industrial Revolution, or even before the post-war period. We can see that even hunters and gatherers and early farmers in various parts of the world had really transformed their local ecologies. And so, you know, I was in part setting out to critique this really fixation on what Europe or Euro-North America was doing to alter the planet. And I wanted to show how there are much deeper roots in terms of how, you know, humanity or various human populations have been shaping planetary environments long before, you know, the arrival of industrial Europe. And so, you know, in this book, I focus specifically on Amazonia.
Yeah, I think that was really great to read that sort of contrast between the two. And also just, I was just really captivated by how you were able to be in the field and observe this close interplay of ecology in the Amazonian. Like I think you mentioned in your book about meeting like rural farmers and Amera Indian settlements to understand like the importance of soil. So is there any specific section of your book that you found particularly telling of this like close interplay between ecology, environment, and humans?
Yeah, there are probably a few different sort of moments that stood out to me when I was doing research. And as a graduate student, I was reading a lot in the area known as historical ecology, which is Bill Ballet describes as a sort of research paradigm that's looking not just at how humans adapt to the environment or how they manipulate the environment, but looking at the interplay between the two. And looking at this sort of give and take between people and their environment. And that was something that was really on my mind. And, you know, it played out in a number of kind of subtle ways. You know, there were times where I had been thinking about all of the sort of media that I consumed as a kid about how, you know, small farmers were, you know, essentially destroying Amazonian environments through slash and burn agriculture. But oftentimes when I sat down and interviewed them, you know, they would talk to me about the endless onslaught of weeds and fungi and pests, right, and different types of disease that would be attacking their crops and made it very challenging to eke out a living as a small farmer in the Amazonian environment. And so, you know, I talk about in the book this idea of this fragile forest was something that seemed wildly foreign to the majority of small farmers I talked to. You know, for them, they were in this battle against this very robust, defiant environment. And, you know, I talk about kind of funny ways in which this is expressed colloquially. People would oftentimes refer to their work as a batalha, which translates, you know, literally as the battle. And so, you know, they oftentimes saw themselves, you know, at war with the pests and you know, invasive weeds that were colonizing their fields. You know, one farmer would ask me about trying to, you know, acquire weed whackers and other sort of forms of mechanization to be able to fight off invasive plants in his manioc fields. And so that really shifted my perspective, or really got me to think differently about the Amazonian environment. And in saying that, I don't want to downplay the fact that there are lots of threats to Amazonian forests. If we look at large-scale soy production, and look at large-scale cattle ranching that we see in western Amazonia. And a good friend of mine, Jeff Holly at the University of California, Santa Barbara, has done a great deal of really fascinating research looking at the rise of Amazonian cowboys. And cattle ranching does have, you know, incredible impacts on Amazonian environments. But if we look at, you know, small farmers who are clearing 1 or 2 hectares of land, you know, they do not see themselves as being masters of their dominion. They see themselves as constantly being challenged by the Amazonian environment. And, you know, for them, it is a gift.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I think that's really like a really telling example of this intricate relationship between the environment and humans and how they come to shape our understanding of the world around us. Some explicit examples that you give in your book are from plants to forests to botanical species. And I wonder what kind of challenges you faced in your field work. I remember reading this part of your book called Saving the Amazon, which touches upon, you kind of talked about this, about holding like a U.S. view versus your own. So I was wondering if you could sort of talk about that.
Yeah, so I think, as you know, I kind of alluded to earlier, growing up in the United States and consuming a lot of media or images that talked about Amazonia as being this environment constantly under threat, you know, I had this perception that, that it was this very sort of fragile environment and that people were just kind of laying waste to it. And, you know, there are academics or scholars at the end of you know, in the 1970s and 1980s that were projecting that, you know, the Amazon would be essentially clear cut by the beginning of the 21st century. And, you know, we found that hasn't yet happened. And of course, as I mentioned, there are lots of ongoing threats to Amazonian environments and Amazonian ecologies. But I think sometimes we also downplay the incredible resilience of Amazonian environments and just the sheer scale of that region. So while there are, you know, concentrated pockets that have been cleared, there are also areas that are, you know, flourishing. And I think in my interactions with rural Amazonian farmers, you know, I realized that things were never so simple. The kind of stereotypes or portrayals that were commonly found in you know, research and popular writings about Amazonia is that there are essentially two types of people. There are, you know, people that are threats to the Amazonian environment, which includes, you know, illegal loggers or illegal miners, or in some cases, you know, large agro-industrialists. And on the other side, there are people that are seeking to protect the forest or to manage it in ways that we would see as more sustainable. And oftentimes, the portrayals you would see is largely of small-scale indigenous populations. And, you know, what I found in my time in rural Amazonia is that there are a lot of people that inhabit the Amazon that don't really fit into either of those, you know, stereotypical portrayals. There are a lot of rural people that are, you know, eking out a living as small farmers. And, you know, I don't see them necessarily, and they don't see themselves as having tremendous environmental impacts. But, you know, are trying to do their best to make a living on the resources available to them. And for a lot of them, you know, they were very much bothered by or perturbed by the fact that, you know, Americans would suggest that they didn't have the right to farm those lands or to be able to try to make a living on, you know, the place that they call home. And, you know, looking further into the history of Amazonia, we see that people have been managing and manipulating the Amazonian environment for hundreds and thousands of years. And I think there was oftentimes this image of Amazonia as a land that's devoid of people. And that's just fundamentally not true, that people have been living in this region for extended period of time and in a lot of ways have become very well adapted to that region. And so to suggest that they simply don't belong or don't have the right to, you know, sustain their livelihoods on the resource available was something that, you know, flew in the face of a deep history that we've come to learn. So, you know, as an American, as an outsider, I had to really grapple with some of my own ideas about the Amazon and some of the kind of problematic portrayals of it that do have real deep political implications. You know, if we suggest that people don't have the right to use Amazonian resources, you know, then you will see lots of people that are being essentially disenfranchised by this desire to conserve, you know, this image of pristine nature. And I think that's deeply problematic.
Yeah, definitely. I do think your book really helps to uncover this sort of myth and these like old ideas of like what the Amazonia depicts. So I was just wondering what you hope to inform readers about your book, or what might they hope to take away?
Well, yeah, as I've said before, I definitely want people to rethink Amazonia and the image of the Amazon. And, you know, today the Amazon is a place that's also becoming increasingly urbanized. So over 75% of people in what Brazil deems the legal Amazon are living in cities. So this image that we have of, you know, small bands of hunters and gatherers that are, you know, interspersed throughout the Amazonian forest just does not align with what the Amazon looks like today, and really doesn't align with what the Amazon's looked like for a long time. It's becoming, you know, an increasingly urbanized and populous place. And, you know, at the same time, I also want us to kind of question this idea of human dominance that I think is insinuated in a lot of discussions about the Anthropocene. You know, humans have had incredible impacts on global environments, and I think those impacts have really increased significantly in, you know, the last 50 to 100 years. But I also think that we really need to be careful in terms of overprivileging human agency and really kind of denying the fact that we are significantly outnumbered on this planet, and to think that the rest of the planet is just going to be a victim to humanity's whims, I think is simply untrue. So the question, you know, moving forward is, you know, how do we live on this planet as a broader socio-ecological collective? And, you know, I think humans for a long time have kind of wanted things to work in our favor, but we're pushing up against a number of forces that ultimately, I think, you know, will prevent us from being able to exert complete control or domination over the planet. And so we really have to think differently. I think we have to think in more ecological terms and think about our relationship to our broader environments in terms of a give and take. And that's something that I really tried to emphasize, especially in the concluding chapter of the book.
Yeah, I think that's definitely like the takeaway message that I got, and just like the ability to critically think and understand ourselves as part of this global ecological and environmental impacts that we might have. So I do think that this was quite an illuminating book, especially because a lot of people might not know very much about the Amazonia. And of course, I think our listeners would like to know, what is the next step with this research, or do you have any future plans?
Yeah, right now I've been working a bit more in the urban Amazon, which is something that really fascinates me. And if we look at the history of Amazonian anthropology, it's really largely been focused on indigenous peoples in Amazonia and in rural areas. And, you know, my research, you know, my previous research also focused in rural areas of Amazonia, kind of following along with that longer history of anthropological investigation in the region. But, you know, as time has gone on, I've found that I can't really deny the simple fact that the majority of people in Amazonia today live in cities that are facing very different types of ecological problems. Right. So the past couple of summers I had been, well, American summers, I had been working in the Peruvian Amazonian city of Iquitos and looking at a community that is currently being threatened to be resettled by the Peruvian government. The Peruvian government has argued that shifts in the course of the Amazon River and also increased frequency of extreme flooding in the area has put people at risk, and so they want to move them away from the floodplain where they're living to an area that's 13 kilometers outside of the city. And in working in this community, you know, a lot of people have lived in this part of the city for 100 years and have learned to adapt to flooding cycles, but also are contending with lots of problems that we see throughout the developing world. They're contending with problems related to management of garbage or solid waste. You know, the city provides municipal solid waste pickup, but in this particular community, they're denied that because they're in this area that's seasonally flooded. They have problems with sanitation, and they're also facing problems with mosquito-borne disease like dengue and Zika. And so I describe these as sort of the troubling ecologies of urban Amazonia today that, while in the past a lot of anthropologists were focused on destruction of Amazonian forests, we see that the majority of people in the Amazon today who are living in cities are contending with very different sort of ecological problems that are linked to changes in precipitation and threats related to flooding that's linked to global climate change. Right. They're also looking at, problems related to diseases that have really, ramped up in lots of developing parts of the world. And, all of these things are sort of interconnected. And so I'm really kind of interested in delving further into urban ecology in Amazonia and looking at how to contend with those problems, because I think those are the problems that are going to affect, the majority of Amazonians today.
Yeah, and I think that's super necessary, also necessary research. And I'm sure when you write a book about that, then we can have you back on our show. But thank you so much for being on our show today.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure.